You go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
It's society. They work for each other, they pay each other, they buy houses, they get married, make children.
That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of shit looking in the mirror at itself.
I can't wait for the episode of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where all the contestants team up and they overpower the host and they share the money.
The message of Occupy Wall Street is I would prefer not to play the existing game.
We are a socialist party and there are social solutions to the problems.
Communal lifestyles, I don't know about that.
No one can tell me what to do.
Wow, you're a real anarchist.
Didn't know we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
No words for you puppets of the West. Communism forever.
God, those communists are amazing.
Good morning, good morning. This is Dan Platt of the Three Left Show, broadcasting live this morning on Saturday the 6th. St. Paddy's Day weekend, I guess. I don't really care. But otherwise, others do, and others can. The quarter of me does. Quarter of me that's actually Irish does care. So this is your weekly, though I'm kind of two on, one off. That's the schedule I think I'm going to stick with. I think I'm liking that. Leftist reading magazine from the far left from Bernie Sanders, far left than any presidential candidate you may have half paid attention to. And I'm going to be talking about environmental stuff today, critiquing capitalism as I go, probably expanding your perspective and getting a little mad. When I read through these the first time, I was seething, actually. But instead, I will simply be quiet and just let you fill in the blanks with your own reactions to what I'm going to be talking about, which is kind of just how messed up our system is. Now, even if we have all these other reforms, like, say, we get single-payer health care, Green New Deal, although, of course, you know, talk about Green New Deal is about going beyond capitalism, if it's implemented the way I would like, the way the Green Party talks about it, and not, you know, social democrats. Even if we get a full social democracy like Denmark, Sweden, what have you, full social welfare, it's still what can be called welfare capitalism. It's capitalism that's nicer, it's capitalism where maybe less people die, but it's still these oppressive relationships, the unequal power dynamics, and the complete dependence on destroying ecosystems. No matter how much corporations tell you about their triple bottom line or their woke version of capitalism where they're going to care about social responsibility, it's really just a coat of paint, because even if their intentions are well, they are still driven subconsciously or by force to maximize profit, to maximize value extraction, which is shorthand for stealing your money or stealing your time. I've been following, you know, I'm a gamer, not by identity, but I play video games, and I don't buy new things really much anymore because now games are live service. That is what the big publishers are doing, almost making playing games into a job. The games have to be time sucks in order to extract the most money from those playing them. It can't just be a one-and-done experience like watching a movie. You go to the movie, you pay once, you watch the movie, you're done. That, or it used to be that with a video game. You'd buy a game once, you'd have it, it would be yours. But now instead, since games are downloaded via online, then there's microtransactions, like you basically pay for the things that would have been in the game, extra characters, stuff, you know, collectibles. Instead of collecting it in the game, you collect it via by paying money for it, basically. Or it acts as a cheat, or something like that. Things that you unlock and have built community over, so to speak, is now something that's completely just a monetary transaction. And now it's like season pass. You subscribe to playing a game. You don't just buy it once, which you, of course you do. You pay it upfront in cost. But then you also have to pay a subscription to the publisher. And it's just value extraction. You know, they just want you to play as much as possible. And all the large, big budget games are now complete time sucks. You know, they can't be completed in 20 to 50 hours, which is kind of a normal expected experience. No, now, like, you're expected to play hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours which is like, and it becomes a chore to do anything, and it becomes a second job, almost, even though it's like meant to be fun, but it's almost like you're working. It's kind of like those dystopian stories, Black Mirror did one, where it's like, you know, you are playing games, but you're like working out, and that's how you generate value for the system, and it's all just slavery at the end of the day, you know, cattle stuff, you know, sorry to bother you. So on, and, because it's all for maximizing profit. Games aren't really just to be enjoyed. And the same goes for the rest of our economy. It isn't really just to satisfy our needs. I mean, that's the kind of superficial reason given for doing it. But the underlying motivation, incentive structure, or, you know, reason for being is to maximize profit, to continue building on it. And that means extracting first from nature, then from humans. And as certain anarchists have pointed out, you can't really break down the oppression of people, like, say, civil, you know, expanding civil rights and economic justice, just justice in general of any kind, unless there is environmental justice, unless we also dissolve the oppressive relationship between man and nature, the antagonism and the general, this is here and we're going to use it up. Even if we're good stewards and we're controlling it, I mean, that's definitely where we want to be and be stewards of each other, so to speak, and be responsible to each other instead of control, domination, so on. So let's just get into it. I've got a lot of great stories here and they're not short. They're longer than some previous episodes where I was brief. Breezing through like eight different things. So environmentalism in general. Let's start with energy and the kind of calls that we're going to, you know, we're getting better all the time. That is what we're told. And I'm not dissuading anyone from doing better, but just like that there's also a cost to doing better. And what is sold as being better and marketed as being better may not actually be better. Here's an example. From an article called Bedazzled by Energy Efficiency. This is from Low Tech Magazine. I like Low Tech Magazine. It's very weird and odd because it has doubts on progress in technology. So half of their articles are critiques of high-end technology. That is high. We have high-tech solutions that will pretty much just benefit capitalists and maybe middle-class people. It'll trickle down the benefits. And then the other half of its articles are about low-tech solutions. So one example of a lot of articles is storing energy. If you listen to billionaires like Elon Musk, the solution is to buy his big lithium batteries or batteries made of rare earth minerals, things that need to be strip-mined out of the earth, and they create complete hellscapes when you do that. And so, but there are mechanical ways of storing energy that are, well, not only more efficient as far as resource use, they take less resources, but are also more friendly to the environment, less harmful, and aren't actually using up nature, because lithium batteries have also a lifespan. They're always working on making it longer, but we don't need a longer way of working off of fossil fuels. We need to get off. We need zero energy. We need to do more. We need to be better than that, than just being more energy efficient. And here's why. I'm reading from the article now. To focus on energy efficiency is to make present ways of life non-negotiable. However, transforming present ways of life is key to mitigating climate change and decreasing our dependence on fossil fuels. Here's the general policy we have so far. Energy efficiency is a cornerstone of policies to reduce carbon emissions and other fossil fuel dependencies in the industrialized world. For example, the EU has set a target of achieving 20% energy savings through improvements in energy efficiency by next year and 30% by 2030. Measures to achieve these goals include mandatory efficiency certificates for buildings, standards, labeling for a variety of products such as boilers, appliances, so on. The EU has the world's most progressive energy efficiency policy, but similar measures are now applied in many other countries, including China. In a global scale, the International Energy Agency, IEA, asserts that energy efficiency is the key to ensuring a safe, reliable, affordable, and sustainable energy system for the future, quote-unquote. In 2011, the organization launched its 450 scenario, which aims to limit the concentration to 450. We're at 412 right now. Per million, parts per million, improved energy efficiency accounts for 71% of projected carbon reductions, which is what I was told in college. Efficiency is 70%, 30% of the energy we use is then, we only, like, for renewables, to switch to renewables, we should be aiming just to have, create 30% of the energy that we do now, because we'll be so efficient, we only need that much energy. Ah, but within our capitalist structure, is that what will actually happen? Let's read on. But what are the results? Do improvements in energy efficiency actually lead to energy savings? At first sight, the advantages of efficiency seem to be impressive. For example, energy efficiency of a range of domestic appliances covered by the EU directive have improved significantly over the last 15 years. Between 1998 and 2012, fridges and freezers became 75% more efficient. Washing machines, 63%. Dryers, 72%. Dishwashers, 50%. However, energy use in the EU, 28 countries in 2015, was only slightly below the energy use in 2000. Furthermore, there are several other factors that may explain the limited decrease in energy use, like the 2007 economic crisis. Indeed, after decades of a continuous growth, energy in the EU decreased slightly between 2007 and 2014, only to go slightly up again in 2015 and 2016 when economic growth returned. On a global level, energy use keeps rising at an average rate of 2.5% a year. This is double the rate of population growth. While close to half of the global population has limited or no access to modern energy sources, in industrialized countries, energy use per head, and i.e. that's white countries, energy use per head of the population doubled between 1960 and 2007. Rebound effects? Here's a question. Why is it that advances in energy efficiency do not result in a reduction of energy demand? Most critics focus on so-called rebound effects, which have been described since the 19th century. According to the rebound argument, improvements in energy efficiency, or efficiency of any kind, often encourage greater use of the service which energy helps to provide. For example, the advance of solid-state lighting, LEDs, which is 6 times more energy efficient than old-fashioned incandescent lights. Right, switching the light bulbs, remember the stamping of feet and crying of, I don't want to switch light bulbs. I don't want to be more efficient. Well, here's the result of being more efficient. It has resulted in demand for 6 times more light. In some cases, rebound effects may be sufficiently large to lead to an overall increase in energy use. For example, the improved efficiency of microchips have accelerated the use of computers, whose total energy use now exceeds the total energy use of an earlier generation of computers, which were less efficient. Energy efficiency advances in one product category can also lead to an increased energy use in other product categories, or lead to the creation of entirely new product categories, because capitalism needs to grow infinitely. Now, defenders would say this is innovation, and this is what progress is. But you see, these new efficiencies, which allow for new product lines and new consumables, is maintaining the planet-destroying economy, because we're using the same amount, if not more, energy. That's energy that in the last several decades has still been a mix of coal, oil, and gas. And the bridge fuel gas, okay, New York City is now entirely heated by gas, frack gas, actually. And we switched to frack gas, which of course is only accelerated the problem of our atmosphere and climate change, as well as creating all of the on-the-ground environmental disasters. Watch the documentary Gasland. So to move beyond the rebound argument, the last few minutes of this section, rebound effects are ignored by Europe and the international consensus, and this might partly explain why the results fall short of the projections. Among academics, the magnitude of the rebound effect is hotly debated. While some argue That rebound effects frequently offset or even eliminate the energy savings from improved efficiency. Others maintain that rebound effects may become a distraction because they are relatively small. Behavioral responses shave 5 to 30% of that intended savings, reaching no more than 60% when combined with macroeconomic effects. Energy efficiency does save energy, says another. Those who downplay rebound effects attribute the lack of the results to the fact that we don't try hard enough. Where have we heard that about relating to inequality, poverty, and so on? Many opportunities for improving energy efficiency still go wasted. Others are driven by the goal of improving efficiency policy. One response suggests that the frame of reference be expanded and that analysts should consider the efficiency of not an individual product, but an entire system, an entire society. In this view, energy efficiency is not framed holistically enough, nor given sufficient context, which is something that markets and capitalism just does not want to do, since it's based on individualized profit, individualized consumption, individualized everything. Think about a parallel universe. Rebound effects are often presented as unintended consequences, but they are the logical outcome of the abstraction that is required to define and measure energy efficiency, meaning the general idea behind the structure of how we think about energy. To start with, the parallel universe of energy efficiency interprets savings in a particular way. When the EU states that it will achieve 20% energy savings, these savings are not defined as a reduction in actual consumption compared to a present or historical figure. Instead, such a definition would show that energy efficiency doesn't reduce energy use at all. Instead, the savings are defined as reductions compared to a projected use. These reductions are measured by quantifying avoided energy, the energy resources not used, meaning that the stats pitched as being like the policy are kind of muddled because they're basically taking it out of context, so to speak. And it's also measuring something that doesn't exist. Treating energy efficiency as a fuel and measuring success in terms of avoided energy is pretty weird. For one thing, it is about not using fuel that does not exist. Furthermore, the higher the projected energy use in 2030, the larger the avoided energy would be. On the other hand, if the projected energy use in 2030 were to be lower than present-day energy use, the avoided energy becomes negative. It looks like then they wouldn't meet their goal. An energy policy that seeks to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and fossil fuel dependency must measure its success in terms of lower consumption. Sounds about right. And yet that's not what we do. However, by measuring avoided energy, the efficiency policy does exactly the opposite. So we have to ask, like, what is it that's efficient? He uses the description of a clothesline. A clothesline uses no energy, so its energy efficiency is actually quite terrible. Based on the standards that, you know, our governments are using to create energy efficiency policy or energy policy, the clothesline's actually very inefficient because it doesn't use any energy at all. Because of the need to compare like with like and establish equivalent of surface, because, you know, we can't have something actually different than what we have now, energy efficiency policy ignores many low-energy alternatives that often have a long history but are still relevant in the context of climate change. For example, the EU has calculated energy labels for tumble dryers will be able to save up to 3.3 terawatts of electricity by 2020, equivalent of the annual energy consumption of Malta. But how much energy use would be avoided if by 2020 every European were using clotheslines instead of tumble dryers? Don't ask the EU, because it has not calculated the avoided energy use of clotheslines. And neither do the IEA, which is the international agency, measure the energy efficiency of avoided energy of bicycles, hand-powered drills, or thermal underwear. Nonetheless, if clotheslines were to be taken seriously as an alternative, then the projected 3.3 terawatts of energy saved by more energy-efficient tumble dryers can no longer be considered avoided energy, let alone a fuel. In a similar way, bicycles and clothing undermine the very idea of calculating avoided energy, of more efficient cars and central heating boilers. Subtitle, Unsustainable Concepts of Service. Concepts of Actual Consumption. The problem with energy efficiency policy is that They are very effective in reproducing and stabilizing, essentially, the unsustainable concepts of service. Measuring efficiency of cars and tumble dryers, but not of bicycles and clotheslines, makes fast but energy-intensive ways of travel or clothes drying non-negotiable, meaning no choice, and marginalizes much more sustainable alternatives. Indeed, the concept of energy efficiency evenly accommodates further growth of energy services. I mean, all that solar energy business, right? We have to keep the machine going. We just have to replace the coal industry with solar industry. And the energy will be less polluting, maybe. I've gone into how it kind of isn't. Since the start of the Industrial Revolution, there has been a massive expansion in the use of energy and in the delegation of human to mechanical forms of power. But although these trends are driving the continuing increase in demand, they cannot be measured through the concept of efficiency. As Stove, scientist, demonstrates, this problem cannot be solved because energy efficiency can only be measured on the basis of an equivalent service. Instead, she argues that the challenge is to debate and extend meanings of service and explicitly engage in ways in which these evolve. System change, not climate change. That's what that boils down to. But what, you know, people say that, but what do they understand what that implicates? This is why I'm going through this. So maybe we should have an energy inefficiency policy. There are several ways to escape from the parallel universe of energy efficiency. First, while energy efficiency hinders, but he uses the term parallel universe because this policy ignores reality. It ignores the reality that we are over-consuming. That is the problem. For example, if we were to install 1960s internal combustion engines into a modern SUV, fuel use per kilometer, this guy is European, I suppose, driven would be much higher than it is today. Few people would be able or willing to afford to drive such cars, and they would have no other choice but to switch to a lighter, smaller, less powerful vehicle, or to drive less. Imagine that. Likewise, if the energy efficiency policy were to mandate the use of inefficient central heating boilers, heating large homes to present-day comfort standards would be also unaffordable. They would be forced to find alternative solutions to find thermal comfort. For instance, heating only one room, dressing more warmly, using personal heaters, and moving to a smaller home. All the things we need to actually do. Recent research into the heating of buildings confirms that inefficiency can actually save energy. A German study examined the calculated energy performance rating of 3,400 homes and compared these with actual measured consumption. In line with the rebound argument, the researchers found that residents of most energy-efficient homes use on average 30% more energy than the calculated rating. However, for less energy-efficient homes, the opposite rebound effect was observed. People use less energy than the models had calculated, and the more inefficient the dwelling is, the larger this gap becomes. In the most energy-inefficient dwellings, energy use was 60% below the predicted level. So, final part here. Instead of talking about efficiency, let's talk about sufficiency. However, while abandoning or reversing energy efficiency policy would arguably bring more energy savings than continuing it, there's another option that's more attractive and could bring even larger energy savings. For an effective policy approach, efficiency can be complemented or perhaps woven into a sufficiency strategy. Energy efficiency aims to increase the ratio of service output. So I'm getting a little jargon here. Sufficiency, by contrast, is a strategy that aims to reduce the growth of energy demand and service. In essence, this is the return to the conservation policies of the 1970s. And I guess they were reversed in the 80s and 90s. Sufficiency can involve a reduction of, and this is why I was not excited about Obama's strides in environmental policy with the EPA, making cars and such more efficient. I mean, that really just means that people can afford to drive more, use the roads more, which requires more road maintenance. It just raises costs in other areas. A sufficiency policy could be developed without a parallel efficiency one, but combining them could bring larger savings. The key step here is to think of energy efficiency as a means rather than an end. For example, imagine how much energy could be saved if we could use an energy-efficient boiler to heat just one room to 16 degrees Celsius, let's say that's 70 degrees Fahrenheit, if we install an energy-efficient engine in a much lighter vehicle, or if we combine an energy-saving shower design with fewer and shorter showers. To quote a kind of little phrase that a waster with an energy-saving device is still a waster. It doesn't matter how many toys and tricks and gadgets you have, it is the people that need to get better. We all need to work on ourselves and each other and be more responsible to each other. That's kind of the message of Black Mirror, that the technology can be perfect, but it's beyond where we people have evolved and progressed. We, as people, have not progressed. We need more social innovation, political innovation. Yeah, so this is sure to be controversial, and it risks being authoritarian, at least as long as there is a cheap supply of fossil fuels. Of course, it's cheap because the true costs are not calculated within the price point. That's kind of what carbon taxes are meant to do. But again, like carbon taxes, as I covered in a different kind of article, that it didn't, like putting on heavy carbon taxes didn't decrease the amount of resource use. It just made the resource use more efficient, allowing for more resources to be used. Rebound effects. So now there's a phrase that I can use now when describing that stuff. Being on a technological treadmill. So let's move on. This one actually is shorter, but related. So as I mentioned, cars. Let's talk about cars. This is from a opinion piece from The Guardian, written by George Monbrot. It's called "Cars Are Killing Us. Within 10 years, we must phase them out." Now, of course, the number 10 years comes from climate reports that to avoid the worst effects. Okay, we're already in the effects of climate change with our more serious winters, storms, and just crazy weather, which is becoming the norm. We have 10 years before it gets even worse, and before, worst case scenario, all life dies. And that's the non-conservative conclusion. And so far, all the scientists, when they put out their conclusions, they've been underestimating how fast things can change, how much effect we do have on the global environment. But here, let's focus instead of the macro, let's focus on the personal cost of our fossil fuel dependence, but particularly what that high energy use economy does, because cars are still, even when electric powered, are still incredibly inefficient ways of travel. Remember, like, you're moving a piece of equipment that's like 1,000 pounds to move you and maybe others that all weigh roughly 500 pounds. That's all together, like if you have a lot of baggage too. But let's say if it's just you in the car and you're 200 pounds, you're moving a 1,000-pound object to move you a 200-pound object. Why? Oh, it's so safe, I guess. Driving is ruining our lives and triggering environmental disasters. Only drastic action can kick our dependency. Now, it was pointed out when I mentioned this meetup last night. He said he was in the car industry. Automobile industry, and I said, like, look, I don't want to alienate you, but my position is cars, whether because he was mentioning how, like, he works for a high-end car company, and they're going electric in ways to outdo Tesla. Instead of using lithium batteries, they're experimenting with mechanical uses of storing energy, much, much better, which is what, like, the Low Tech magazine kind of mentioned. Flywheels, springs, stuff like that. But I said, like, well, a car's still a car. We still need, like, highways and all this car infrastructure that destroys our cities and our urban fabric and eventually our rural fabric with suburbia. I think everyone knows something's wrong with it. Maybe they can't articulate it, but there are definitely lots of books on the subject, so you can articulate it. So let's go into his opinion piece. Lots of vitriol here. It's the last straw. Parked outside the hospital doors is a minibus with its engine running. The driver is playing on his mobile phone. The fumes are blowing into the atrium. I step up to his window and ask him to turn the engine off. He does so, grumpily. Then I notice he's wearing a health service uniform. I walk through the atrium, down a corridor, and into the cancer department. Not for cancer this time, but to talk about reconstructive surgery. I look around the huge waiting room and wonder how many of the people sitting here might be ill as a result of air pollution. I think of people in other departments, children of asthma attacks, patients being treated for road injuries, or suffering from a lifetime of inactivity, as wheels replace their feet. And I'm stuck by the amazing variety of ways in which cars have ruined our lives. Let's abandon this disastrous experiment. Recognize that this 19th century technology is now doing more harm than good, and plan our way out of it. Let's set a target to cut the use of cars by 90% over the next decade. Why 90? Because yes, cars are still useful. For a few people, essential. It would make a good servant, but it has become our master, and it spoils everything it touches. It now presents us with a series of emergencies that demand an emergency response. One of these emergencies is familiar to every hospital. Pollution now kills 3 times as many people worldwide as AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria combined. So, thanks a lot, Bill Gates. It's all malaria, but asthma kills 3 times as many. Why don't you tackle that? Oh, yeah, because it's a systemic problem that you can't just throw money at. Remember the claims at the start of the century, projected so noisily by the billionaire press, that public money would be better spent on preventing communicable disease than on preventing climate breakdown. It turns out that the health dividend from phasing out fossil fuels is likely to have been much bigger. Of course, there was nothing stopping us from spending money on both. It was always a false dilemma. Burning fossil fuels, according to a recent paper, is now, quote, the world's most significant threat to children's health. In other sectors, greenhouse gas emissions have fallen sharply, but transport emissions in the UK have declined 2%. So again, back to the rebound effect. More efficient vehicles, but the actual emissions from those vehicles haven't declined very much since 1990. The government's legally binding target is an 80% cut by 2050, though even this, the science now tells us, is hopelessly inadequate. Transport, mostly because of our obsession with the private car, is now a major factor in driving us towards climate breakdown in this and many other nations. And I want to point out that the guy, a fellow lefty who works in the car industry, pointed out that as far as, say, the mass amount of fuel used in private vehicles is still dwarfed by the use of fossil fuels in airplanes and shipping. And he's totally right. Especially because the fuels used in those things are dirtier, create more emissions. And generally, the kind of travel is less essential. Why do we make stuff a continent away and ship it here when we could be making it here? The answer is it benefited capitalists to do it that way. Because the cost of shipping it overseas and the burning of all this fuel is not factored into their bottom line. Now, if they have that triple bottom line, maybe, but notice that many corporations haven't actually done that, because if they did, then their models would just collapse, like it wouldn't work. The bankers plan the economy, and they say that isn't feasible. It's not feasible to be sustainable, to actually be green. The number of people killed on the roads was falling steadily in the UK until 2010, at which point the decline suddenly ended. Why? Because while fewer drivers and passengers are dying, the number of pedestrians killed has risen by 11%. In the U.S., it's worse, with a 51% rise in annual death rate of pedestrians since 2009. In the last decade, there seems to be 2 reasons. Drivers distracted on mobile phones and a switch from ordinary cars to sport utility vehicles. As SUVs are higher and heavier, they were more likely to kill the people they hit, and driving an SUV in an urban area is an antisocial act. There are also more subtle and pervasive effects. Traffic mutes community, as the noise, danger, and pollution in busy streets drive people indoors. The places in which children could play and adults could sit and talk are reserved instead for parking. Energy noise, a great but scarcely acknowledged cause of stress and illness, fill our lives. We jostle to secure a road space as we swear and shake our fists at other drivers, pedestrians, and cyclists as we grumble about speed limits and traffic calming. Cars change us, enhancing our sense of threat and competition, cutting us off from each other. First episode, I think, yes, I still have it on archived in my website, threelefts.news. I do also read another screed against cars. The other one, also opinion, of course, it has to be an opinion piece. It's not like they're actually print how we need to phase out cars as a policy. It's not something that's even discussed. It was about banning cars entirely, except for, like, exceptions. And for him, like he says, like, phase out to 90%. 10% would be the exceptions. Exceptions for the handicapped. Exceptions for emergency vehicles. Just like certain European cities and other cities have banned cars, private vehicles from their downtowns and from large swaths of their... I left off with that cars change us and cut us off from each other. New roads carve up the countryside, dispelling the peace, creating a prenumbella of noise, pollution, and ugliness. Their effects spread for many miles. The disposition of reactive nitrogen from car exhaust, and among other factors, changes the living system, even of remote fastness. In Snowdenia, it has dropped at the rate of 24 kilograms per hectare per year, radically altering plant communities. Wars are fought to keep down the cost of driving. Hundreds of thousands died in Iraq partly for this purpose. The earth is reamed with the mines required to manufacture cars, and the oil wells needed to power them. A switch to electric cars addresses some of these issues. Already, beautiful places are being wrecked by an electric vehicle resource rush. Lithium mining, for example, is now poisoning rivers and depleting groundwater from Tibet to Bolivia. They still require a vast expenditure of energy and space. They still need tires, whose manufacture and disposal is a massive environmental blight, because tires are too complex to recycle. Tire fires aren't going away, folks. We are told that cars are about freedom of choice, but every aspect of this assault on our lives is assisted by state planning and subsidy, something I figured out writing a paper in college. Roads are built to accommodate projected traffic, which then grows to fill the new capacity. Rebound effect. Streets are modeled to maximize the flow of cars. Pedestrians and cyclists are squeezed by planners into narrow and often dangerous spaces. The afterthoughts of urban design. If we paid for residential street parking at market rates for land, renting the 12 square meters a car requires would cost about £3,000 a year in the richer parts of Britain. The chaos on our roads is a planned chaos. But instead, transport should be overall planned, but with an entirely different aim: to maximize its social benefits while minimizing harm. This means a wholesale switch towards electric mass transit, safe and separate bike lanes, and broad pavements accompanied by a steady closure of the conditions that allow cars to rampage through our lives. In some places and for some purposes, using cars is unavoidable, but for a great majority of journeys, they can be easily substituted, as you can see in cities like Amsterdam, Podveria, and Copenhagen, Denmark. We could also eliminate them from our cities. In this age of multiple emergencies, climate chaos, pollution, and third, and importantly, social alienation, we should remember that technologies exist to serve us, not to dominate us. It is time to drive the car out of our lives. Now this is where I get even heavier, okay? Because talking about the energy efficiency of appliances and then cars, which again is a very small piece of our consumption pie, as can easily be pointed out, buildings consume a much higher quantity of the energy, not only in their construction, but their daily use. You know, and the solution isn't switching from oil boilers to gas boilers, that's just switching one fuel with another. But now for something heavier, okay? Now, this is from The Atlantic, so more mainstream source. But they're reporting on something that is, to me, it's been on my mind for a while. And so what I do with this show format is kind of like another podcast I really love called The Sea Realm that isn't circulated anymore. It ended. And I mentioned in a previous episode, China isn't accepting our recycling goods anymore. And I kind of touched on it in a more greater context of talking about how unsustainable our system is, and I left it at that. But I definitely wanted to dive deeper into that problem and how all of the half measures of progress and greenwashing and we're becoming sustainable 10% at a time. This article, hopefully, I do not mean this as a cynical program, but a bucket of cold water on our lackadaisical sensibilities about we are getting better all the time, just we increased our recycling rate. And again, that's how cities are still thinking about it. They're still thinking about energy efficiency. And I went into how that's a problem. But here's an article called Is This the End of Recycling? Written by Alana Samuels. Subtitle, Americans are consuming more and more stuff. Now that other countries won't take our paper and plastic, they're ending up in the trash. After decades of earnest public information campaigns, Americans are finally recycling, asterisk. I put that there. Airports, malls, schools, and office buildings across the country have bins for plastic bottles and aluminum cans and newspapers. Although, I will say aside, there are still many workplaces that I have been in that don't have recycling bins currently available. So actually, no, we're not all recycling. In some cities, you can be fined if inspectors discover that you haven't recycled appropriately. Like New York City, that mostly falls on superintendents. But now much of that carefully sorted recycling is ending up in the trash. For decades, we were sending the bulk of our recycling to China. Tons and tons of it. Sent over on ships, gas-guzzling ships, to be made into goods such as shoes and bags and new plastic products. But last year, the country restricted imports of certain recyclables, including mixed paper, magazines, office paper, junk mail, and most plastics. Waste management companies across the country are telling towns, cities, and counties that there is no longer a market for their recycling, and that this is not the first time. I'm going to stress every time the word market comes up in this article. They don't put it in bold, but I'm going to verbally do that, okay? Markets. These municipalities have two choices. Pay much higher rates to get rid of recycling, or throw it all away. Most are choosing the latter. Ah, we are doing our best to be environmentally responsible, but we can't afford it, says Julie Miner, the city manager of Franklin, New Hampshire. Since 2010, Franklin has offered curbside recycling and encouraged residents to put paper, metal, and plastic in their green bins. When the project program launched, Franklin could break even on recycling by selling it for $6 a ton. Now, Minow told me, the transfer station is charging the town $125 a ton to recycle, or they were charged $68 a ton to incinerate it. One-fifth of Franklin's residents live below the poverty line, and the city government didn't want to ask them to pay more to recycle. So all those carefully sorted bottles and cans are being burned. Milner hates knowing that Franklin is releasing toxins into the environment, which will then increase health care costs of those poverty stricken and middle class residents. But there's not much she can do. Quote, plastic is just not one of the things that we have a market for, she said. There's that word again. The same thing is happening across the country. In Broadway, Virginia had a recycling program for 22 years, pretty long running, but recently suspended it after waste management told the town that prices would increase 63%. And then stopped offering recycling pickup as a service entirely. Quote, it almost feels illegal to throw plastic bottles away, the town manager Kyle O'Brien told me. Without a market for mixed paper, bales of the stuff started to pile up in Blaine County, Idaho. The county eventually stopped collecting it and took the 35 bales it had hoped to recycle to a landfill. The town of Fort Edward, New York, in my area, suspended its recycling program in July and admitted it had actually been taking recycling to an incinerator for months, determined to hold out until the market turned around. The nonprofit Keep Northern Illinois Beautiful has collected 400,000 tons of plastic, but for now, it is piling the bales behind the facility where it collects it. This end of recycling comes at a time when the United States is creating more waste than ever. Now, in the previous show where I mentioned this problem, it was about creating less waste and having a less wasteful product stream of consumption. So you can keep that in mind. Listen to that show for more, like, what are some people doing about it and what can we do about it? In 2015, the most recent year for which national data is available, somehow, America generated 264 million tons of waste, up to 4.5% up from 2010 and 60% more than 1985. That amounts to nearly 5 pounds per person a day. Wow. New York City collected 900, I'm reading this in a surprised tone. I'm actually seething with rage. The amounts to nearly 5 pounds per person a day. New York City collected 934 tons of metal, plastic, and glass a day from residents last year, a 33% increase from 2013. And then they link an article called "We Are All Accumulating Mountains of Things." For a long time, America had had little incentive to consume less. Rebound effects and our market capitalist infinite growth system. Remember, if you haven't heard a critique of GDP, that breaking windows and having them replaced increases GDP. More healthcare services, more people getting sick increases GDP. GDP only measures the amount of dollars flowing or the amount being spent, not the actual, you know, positive or negative effects. Okay. But a planned economy could do that much better. There are people like, well, if we just change the indicators, then we can have a ethical capitalism. But Wall Street doesn't care about having different indicators. That's why, like, I've been hearing the critique of GDP mentioned as a, it's not a movement yet, it's a current. And I've been hearing the critique of GDP from economists and such for years. I've been hearing it since 2008, basically since the crash. The recession started in 2008. And I haven't seen any goddamn change from anyone, except for Bhutan. They changed their economic indicators from GDP to something about happiness, measuring people's happiness. I'd like to do that. Okay, moving on. For a long time, okay, so I'm about to hit the end of the break. Actually, you know what? Okay, I'll stop there. Go into housekeeping. Yep, I'm in the last minute here. I'll pick this up on the other side of the hour. Please stay with me if you'd like to hear the rest of that. If you can't because you're in a car or something like that, just think about how free you are to keep listening to the show because you're in a car. A reminder that to grow the show, word of mouth is the best thing you can do to take part in that. You can leave a review for the podcast, for the show, on all the podcast platforms which it is found. I don't think I've been close to the mic enough. Share Three Lefts via chosen social media. We're on Facebook and Twitter. And I share all edited versions of the show on those platforms. To support the show materially, you can visit our Patreon page, Three Left Show. Become a member there. Find the show archived at threeleft.news. That's threelefts.news, where a full backlog of episodes and found, as well as other resources. I have now listed all the YouTubers I like and other lefty podcasts that you might be interested in listening to. So otherwise, this has been the Three Left Show, and we give everyone, rate everyone a 10 for being the best at being themselves. So thank you for joining me for the first hour. I'll see you on the second. Have a good one. Come Welcome, welcome to the second hour of the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, broadcasting from Pewanawatu, Marikananu, Turtle Island. That is the name, Iroquois name, for where I live, Albany, New York. People who actually should own this land. It's theirs, really. And that's what makes us white, because we live on land that isn't originally ours, and say it is, if you say it's our land. But our land is your land, it's made for you and me, blah, blah, blah. Yesterday, I went to, there was a international student strike for climate justice. Very encouraging. Here in our area, which isn't very, it's activist heavy enough. But we basically, 80 students went on strike. They actually took the day off. I mean, really, going on strike is just taking the day off. And if more of us take the day off all at once, I mean, that's how you shut things down. Where you go, one person leaves an office that's going on strike, and you go into the office next door, and you say, we need to go on strike, we shouldn't be taking this anymore, let's meet in the park and form some demands. You know, that's what Occupy was. It was people taking the day off. Just take the day off once in a while. If you can't, you know, that's exactly what makes you a slave, isn't it? If you can't even take the day off to assert your rights, what rights do you really have? So, not quite segueing, but I'm going to pick up where I left off in the last hour, talking about recycling is a dead dog, and you have all these municipalities. There is no market for recycled goods anymore. It's just too expensive to recycle, they say. Too much money for market economy. So for a long time, Americans have had little incentive to consume less. It's inexpensive to buy products, and it's even cheaper to throw them away at the end of their very short lives. But the cost of all this garbage is growing, especially now that bottles and papers that were once recycled are now ending up in the trash. One of the costs is environmental. When organic waste hits a landfill, it decomposes, emitting methane, which is bad for the climate and makes all that smell. Landfills are the largest source of methane emissions in the country. Burning plastic may create some energy, but it also produces carbon emissions. And while many incineration facilities bill themselves as waste-to-energy plants, studies have found that they release more harmful chemicals, such as mercury and lead, into the air per unit of energy than coal plants. And as cities are now learning, the other cost is financial. The United States still has a fair amount of landfill space left, but it's getting expensive to ship waste hundreds of miles to those landfills. Some dumps are raising costs to deal with all this extra waste. According to one estimate, along the West Coast, landfill fees increased by $8 a ton from 2017 to 2018. Some of these costs are already being passed on to consumers, but most haven't yet. Americans are going to have to come to terms with this new reality. All those toothpaste tubes and shopping bags and water bottles that didn't exist 50 years ago need to go somewhere. And creating this much waste has a price we haven't had to pay for so far. We've had an ostrich-in-the-sand approach to the entire system, says Jeremy O'Brien, the director of applied research at the Solid Waste Association of North America, a trade association. Quote, we are producing a lot of waste ourselves, and we should take care of it ourselves. As the trash piles up, American cities are scrambling to figure out what to do with everything they had previously sent to China. But few businesses want it domestically, for one very big reason. Despite all the advertising campaigns, Americans are terrible at recycling. About 25% of what ends up in the blue bins is contaminated, according to the National Waste and Recycling Association. For decades, we've been throwing just about whatever we wanted. Wire hangers, pizza boxes, ketchup bottles, and yogurt containers into the bin and sending it to China, where low-paid workers sorted through it and cleaned it up. That's no longer an option. And in the United States, at least, it rarely makes sense to employ people to sort through our recycling so that it can be made into new material, because virgin plastic and paper is still cheaper in comparison. And it's cheaper because the land, you don't actually have to pay for the land use rights. Just extract, extract, extract. Even in San Francisco, often lauded for its environmentalism, waste management companies struggle to keep recycling uncontaminated. I visited a state-of-the-art facility operated by San Fran's recycling provider, Recology, where million-dollar machines separate aluminum from paper, from plastic, from garbage. But as the Recology spokesman, Robert Reed, walked me through the plant, he kept pointing out non-recyclables, gumming up the works. Workers wearing masks and helmets grabbed laundry baskets off a fast-moving conveyor belt of cardboard as some non-cardboard items escaped their gloved hands. Recology has to stop another machine twice a day so a technician can pry plastic bags from where they've clogged up the gears. Cleaning up recycling means employing people to slowly go through materials, which is expensive. Now, I want to point out that a lot of these troubles exist because we do not actually have a review process for products. Now, it's proposed that we fix this problem of markets by putting standards, planning, so to speak, that all producers of things need to plan that their products be reusable and be able to be recycled cheaply, or more specifically, just reusable and or biodegradable for the most part, so that we can still have our single-use items, because we can't let go of that apparently, and but that at least they can be decomposed in the landfill. Because most of the landfills have like kind of created systems to collect the methane gas that comes off of dumps, to burn it as a natural gas. That's still, you know, fossil fuel stuff, and it's still more of a, it's better than not. But still, it could be compost, which could rejuvenate our soil instead of using oil-based fertilizers. Cleaning up recycling means employing people to slowly go through the materials, which is expensive. Jacob Greenberg, a commissioner in Blaine County, Ohio, told me that the country's mixed paper recycling was about 90% clean, but its paper broker said the mixed paper needed to be 99% clean for anyone to buy it. An elected official didn't want to hike fees to get there. At what point do you feel like you're spending more money than what it takes for people to feel good about recycling? He said. Then there's the challenge of educating people about what can and can't be recycled. Now, no, of course, when I'm mad about this stuff, I'm not mad at people. I'm more mad at the idea that we've just wasted a lot of time. Since I was a child, I was told that recycling was the answer. It was a way that we could keep consuming and but have a greener future. You know, sustainability wasn't a buzzword then, but certainly it was an alternative to waste incineration put in our communities, which then gave them all lung cancer. And so it's just a lot of wasted time. Time that we could have been using to really discuss and have policy debates. But instead we got energy bills like in the aughts that just were giveaways to the oil industry and deregulated them further so fracking could then come about. It's all buying time, so to speak. But of course, making everything much, much worse in the process. Like fracking for natural gas, the bridge fuel, has in fact accelerated greenhouse gas emissions. Rebound effect. Then there's the challenge of educating people about what can and can't be recycled, even as the number of items that they touch on a daily basis grows. Americans tend to be aspirational about the recycling, tossing the item in the blue bin because it makes them feel less guilty about consuming it and throwing it away. I myself am guilty about this. I'm mad at myself. Even in San Francisco, Reed kept pointing out items that aren't easily recyclable, but that keep showing up in the Recology plant. Soy sauce packets and pizza boxes, candy bar wrappers and dry cleaner bags, the lids of to-go coffee cups and plastic takeout containers. If we could somehow figure out how to better sort recycling, some U.S. markets for plastics and paper may emerge, but selling it domestically will still be harder than it would be in a place such as China, where a booming manufacturing sector has constant demand for such materials. The viability of recycling varies tremendously. Now, of course, the reason why they've cut off the spigot, so to speak, from buying our recyclables is because they are sort of plateauing and they're not growing as fast anymore. They've decided, because they do have more planned economy, that they don't need to grow anymore. They have reached a point where They can create consumer goods for everybody in China. We can stop now. Imagine that. The ability to say stop. No more. That's something our economy cannot possibly do. The viability of recycling varies tremendously by locale. San Francisco can recycle its glass back into bottles in 6 weeks, according to Ecology, while many other cities are finding that glass is so heavy and breaks so easily that it is nearly impossible to truck it to a place that will recycle it. Akron, Ohio is just one of the many cities that have ended glass recycling since the China policy change. For now, it's still often cheaper for companies to manufacture using new materials than recycled ones. Michael Rohner, a director of business for social responsibility, paradox if you ask me, works with companies that try to be more environmentally friendly. He told me the recycled plastic costs pennies more than new plastic. And those pennies add up when you're manufacturing millions of items. Items made of different types of plastic nearly always end up in the trash because recyclers can't separate the plastics from one another. If you look on your recyclable, quote-unquote recyclable plastic, you'll see a number inside the recycle logo, 1 to 6. And that's those different types of plastics that can't actually be mixed together. And the amount of plastic that can be reused in such things, like the one plastic, half of it's reusable. And by the time you get down to the 6, it's like 5% can actually be recyclable. It's really like not worth it at all. Reed equates to trying to get the sugar and eggs out of a cake after you've baked it. But because companies don't bear the cost of disposal, they have no incentive to manufacture products out of material that will be easier to recycle. The best way to fix recycling is probably persuading people to buy less stuff, which would also have the benefit of reducing some of the upstream waste created. But that's a hard sell in the U.S., where consumer spend amounts to 68% of the GDP, because we so care about that. The strong economy means more people have more spending money, too. Ooh, so because it's so good. Trump's such a good president. And often the things they buy, such as new phones and the places they shop, such as Amazon, are designed to sell them more. The average American spends 7% more on food and 8% more on personal care products and services. So again, another rebound effect. More recycling has only made people feel okay about consuming more in the first place. And it doesn't help that all these companies, having an infinite growth imperative, have to keep selling us more each year in order to keep value up. Their profits, their ability to stay afloat. So say the bank. Some places are still trying to get people to buy less, I guess. The city of San Francisco, for instance, is trying to get residents to think of a fourth R beyond reduce, reuse, and recycle. Refuse. I'd rather not. It wants people to be smarter about what they purchase, avoiding plastic bottles and straws and other disposable goods. But it's been tough in a place centered on acquiring the newest technology. Quote, this is our big challenge. How do you take a culture like San Francisco and get people excited about less? Well, we can bring back the less is more approach as a motto. Debbie Raquel, the director of the San Fran Department of Environment, told me, the city passed an ordinance to require that 10% of beverages sold be available in reusable containers. And it was trying to make reuse hip through an online campaign and dedicated website. Her name is Raphael. San Fran and other Bay Area cities have banned plastic bags and plastic straws, but that option isn't available in many other parts of the country, where recently passed state laws prevent cities from banning. Those would be the Midwest states. But even in San Fran, the most careful consumers still generate a lot of waste. Plastic clamshell containers, for example, are difficult to recycle because the material they're made of is so flimsy. But it's hard to find berries not sold in such containers. If you go to a co-op or a farmer, they'll use their paper ways of having berries around, but they're not, you know, you can't store them for a long time. You actually have to use things the week you buy them. Here. Even at Recology, that recycling plant, an employee-owned company that benefits, and by employee-owned, it may just mean the employees get stock options, doesn't specify, not a co-op, that benefits when people recycle well, the hurdles of getting rid of plastics were evident. Reed chided me for eating my daily Chobani yogurt out of a small 5-ounce container rather than out of a big 32-ounce one. But I saw a 5-ounce Yoplait container in the trash can of the control room. While there, Reed handed me a pair of small orange earplugs meant to protect my ears from the noise of the plant. They were wrapped in a type of flimsy plastic that is nearly impossible to recycle. When I left the plant, I kept the earplugs and the plastic in my bag, not sure what to do with them. Eventually, I threw them in the trash. Something we should eventually do to our system, bit by bit. And that was written by Alana Samuels, a staff writer at The Atlantic. And I said The Atlantic would actually kind of cover just how deep this problem is and how we're all contributing to it, as we are all members of our economic system. I just, my only recourse is to participate as little as possible. And that's where refuse takes on a much stronger meaning. Not just refusing to buy less, or refusing advertising, but refusing to participate entirely. A strike is, as far as labor's context of labor, is refusing to produce value for the boss. It hurts them more than it hurts you, especially if it's a short-term strike. A few days, even, can hurt profits immensely and really gum up the work, so to speak. I covered this in the last episode or so about increase in smaller strikes, and very encouraging that it's just a small baby step of sorts to take the day off once for like a once a year action or for a holiday that isn't a national one, so you don't get it off. To take the day off, or as if you're not allowed vacation days or the like, sick days, just call in sick. You're not going to get paid, but you create more value for your boss than for yourself. Always keep that in mind, that you are always creating more value for who you're working for than what you're paid. So it always hurts them, the owners, the capitalists, the elites, whoever you hate who's, you know, better off than you. Not to play into the whole, like, leftists are just jealous and envious and they hate. And we're not the hateful ones. But it's not about hate. It's just about recognizing what our actual relationships and what the real problems are. Just big and big they are, and just how insurmountable they are. Even the solutions proposed in this one in this article, that you know, it wouldn't really get rid of the problem. It would only just alleviate some of the pressure. Maybe create a market, because having a recycling market was so good so far. It's been working well so far. We just need to keep it going. No, it's failed. Back to the show. Talking about our overconsumption of stuff and the seemingly oversmeltable problems of our market economy. Now, I was asked by a friend, you know, Dan, are you for the abolition of markets? I'm like, well, that's kind of a loaded question, because abolition kind of, using that word, kind of implicates that it would be authoritarian, like by edict, that we would just say no more markets. But like with the cars, like how I read one article last year about banning cars, and this time I read an article piece that used the phrase phasing out, right? Now, it's also a matter of choices. Now, if it's a choice between market economy that is destroying the environment and having a livable planet in which we're not destroying the environment, I will have to choose the latter. Now, I'm setting up a binary that may be a false dilemma that many argue is a false dilemma. But my theme here today in the articles and the way I'm presenting this information here is that that is the way I see it. Or, like, let's say if it's abolishing the police, right? If it's a choice between the police continue to unaccountably kill black people, brown people, and some light-skinned people, and steal property from people, and so on, and as an institution have prisons that jail 20% of our population, higher than anyone else in the world, if it's a choice between that and abolishing them, or phasing out prisons and police, phasing out being the operable phrasing, then yes, I choose the latter. Make the argument for that. How to do that? What would we be phasing to? We would be phasing into something else. Just as phasing and banning cars doesn't mean a transportation system, because obviously there is no alternative unless we are phasing into better bus service, full bike lanes and bike shop and bike repair on every corner, and a train system, like those fun little maps where we like have a high-speed train network where you can travel across multiple states in half a day instead of a whole day. So now, still focusing on like going from recycling of the stuff to the consuming and the kind of other streaming of the stuff in a different kind of mode here, not just about the, but also again trying to make it personal again as well. Now this article from Roar magazine, so much more leftist here, in the Society and Solidarity section. The article is called "Death by Charity." So again, bucket of cold water on sensibilities. This is meant to be cynical and to say, stop what you're doing. You're a bad person because you give to charity. It's just pointing out that there are systemic problems with charity. So the death of a homeless woman in the slot of a clothing donation box serves as a harsh reminder. Capitalism kills, and quote-unquote charity is one of its tools. The author is Kajigi Kajai. Not pronouncing it correctly. And starts with a mentioning of Marie Kondo. In the newly released Netflix show, Tidying Up with Marie Kondo, I did watch an episode. I kind of enjoyed it. I thought there were some neat things there. The Ammonious host demonstrates the art and joy of conscious decluttering through a series of home makeovers. As illustrated by the widespread media coverage and social media excitement, the show clearly resonates with those of us who simply have too much and would be happier with less. Less is more. Amid the hashtag KonMari buzz, came news of the tragic death of Crystal Pompano, a 35-year-old homeless woman in Toronto who died while trapped in the deposit slot of a clothing donation bin. She had likely been searching for warm clothes that would sustain her during the harsh winter months. Sorry, the nuisance of access and the deadliness of deprivation make for a sharp and devastating outline of the binary reality of life under capitalism. This was an inevitable tragedy. Indeed, Pompano's death is devastating, but as housing and shelter activists have noted, it is not surprising. There are over 8,000 homeless people in Toronto, Canada's largest city. The night Pompano died, Toronto shelters were, like so many other nights, at capacity. Amid these conditions of widespread homelessness and insufficient respite, 145 homeless people died in Toronto between January 1st and June 30th. Now, I want to make a comparison here, not to, again, denigrate that we had another mass shooting, this time in New Zealand, so not in America this time, but that's what makes it so special, that it occurred in a country that isn't America. But still, alienation is a global problem because we live in global capitalism. It was, what was it, 50 people dead? Very high death count. Of course, it makes us sad and angry to learn of such death. And such death also occurred in our cities this year, in winter. I think it was death toll was 60 in Chicago. Wonder what the numbers were in New York City. The same death toll in each city of the homeless population. But slow deaths. And Toronto is 145. This year, Pompano has already been replaced as the latest death of a homeless person in the city. Pompano's death is devastating, but it is not unprecedented. At least 6 others in Canada have died after becoming stuck in donation bins. An incident in West Vancouver led to the closure of all of its city's receptacles. Pompano's death is devastating, and it should be ironic. A woman living in poverty was killed by the infrastructure specifically designed to facilitate charitable giving. But it is only ironic if we consider charity to be separate from and counter to the cruel and violent logic of capitalism. In reality, charity is not only compatible with it, it is a product of its logic and makes its continuation possible. Partner in crime. Consider one particular charitable industry in Canada, food banks. On the left, we call these capitalist breadlines. Introduced as a stopgap measure against the recession in the 80s to mitigate the pressures of unemployment, yet 30 years later, they are a mainstay of our landscapes. Each month in Canada, 850,000 people in Canada access food banks. As Canadian food security activists note, food banks fail to address even the immediate needs of those who are food insecure. Only about 1 in 4 households experiencing food insecurity actually uses a food bank. And for those who do, the rations are insufficient and unpredictable. I myself can attest to this. I live with someone who was using the food bank, and what he would bring home would be a hodgepodge of some usable stuff and sometimes unusable stuff. It was meant to supplement what, like, you basically fill in the gaps of the ingredients by going to the store. But if you can't go to the store, you're left with a lot of random things. A lot of random ingredients, some canned goods, be a lot of fruit sometimes, but a lot of it would be squished. In 2016, 1 in 6 Canadian households that rely on food banks had members that were currently or recently employed, belying the myth that participation in the capitalist market safeguards against poverty. That 36% of food bank users in Canada are children of youth reflects the sobering reality that our economic situations are largely outside of our control. Our lives are governed by whether we are born on the winning or losing side of a sometimes fuzzy economic divide. As Food Bank Canada notes, the root cause of hunger in Canada is low income, which consistently affects more than 4 million of us at any given time. Now, I've been in conversations with people who even donate to food banks and donate to many charities, but they still have an attitude of poverty is caused by poor judgment or bad decisions or having too many kids. Poverty is a lack of money, first and foremost. That is all it is. Once you have more money, once you have stable income, then the better decisions or better lifestyles follow. But, as I'm pointing out, these better lifestyles, better incomes, are inherently wasteful. It means buying more, having more stuff, making more trash. Is that what we want everyone to do? But food banks do not actually address the endemic of low income. In Ontario, food banks are serving more and more people, even while measures guaranteed to exacerbate inequality and poverty are being implemented. Repeal of the planned increase in minimum wage to $15 an hour, still itself insufficient given the cost of living. The cancellation of the basic income pilot project and cuts to planned increases in social assistance. Food banks can and do coexist with the very measures that create food insecurity. Indeed, the Daily Bread Food Bank CEO, Neil Hetherington, made clear that province-wide cuts to social assistance will drive up food bank use. Food banks are the economic equivalent of Febrezing, an overflowing garbage bin. They minimize the stench of inequity, making the rot slightly less putrid, even as it continues to fester. We don't need to take the garbage out if we can keep the odor under gag-worthy. Never mind that we continue to ingest its noxious fumes. Charity is a wolf in sheep's clothing. Charity functions so well within capitalism because it stabilizes the political, social, and effective disequilibrium created by the extreme inequality that it creates. Engenders. Under capitalism, there is no incongruence between the numerous charitable ventures of the fast food franchise Tim Hortons. You can replace that with McDonald's. Children's camps, sports leagues, food giveaways, and support for coffee farmers in the global south, and notorious pouting and petulance about the minimum wage increase in Ontario. Franchisees, scrap workers' paid breaks, and health and dental plans to offset the legislated increase to the minimum wage in Ontario. Corporation that annually sends 20,000 kids from low-income families to participate in a life-changing camp experience is making sure that those employees, so this very company, is also making sure that those it employs cannot afford to send their own kids to any camp whatsoever. Tim Hortons willingly redistributes wealth through its charitable projects, but forced redistribution of wealth through wages is unappealing. Paying people for their work is an obligation, not an option. A legal duty, not a gift. There is no moral benefit to be extracted from settling your debts to your employees. On the contrary, wages force recognition that the profit interests of corporations are only satisfied by the hard work of wage labor employees. Like I was saying before, charity distracts us, and more generally, charity reconciles the immorality of extreme inequality by attributing morality to the people and institutions that benefit from it. While charity redistributes some wealth, it does so through a mechanism that justifies that unequal distribution. It ensures that there are always people sufficiently impoverished to rely on a corporation's charitable handouts, and that we are sufficiently grateful to not question the need for such handouts. Charity operates as a bomb, B-A-L-M, on the individual level as well. Charity abates the guilt of our excesses, like recycling, and even makes us feel good about ourselves. A hand reaching out for help can be used to pat ourselves on the back, a perversity that speaks to the all-encompassing power of economic well-being in a capitalist world order. Wealth endows us with the capacity to not only take, but also to give, to enjoy not only material comfort, but moral comfort as well. But charity is dependent upon our ability to give, and not another's right to receive. Donors choose what to give, how to give, when to give, and to whom. We give when it is convenient, perhaps part of a condo-inspired decluttering project. When it is no longer comfortable for us to do so, we will stop. Studies show that donations drop during difficult economic times. That this happens at the precise moment when it is most needed is a testament to the fact that in the charitable relationship, agency is the exclusive privilege of the donor. Charity is also used to fix what capitalism breaks, right? Capitalism destroys community and neighborhoods. So then we need all of these charities to help rebuild communities. So fixing what capitalism broke. The success of capitalism lies on its ability to create solutions to problems of its own making. Too much stuff? Buy Marie Kondo's book and learn how to whittle down your excesses. Exhausted from the 9-to-5 workday? Spend the money you earn to buy a spa package or a vacation to unwind. Massive economic inequality? Try charity. That the very same capitalist entity is often implicated in creating both the problem and its solution, as Nestle, which continued production of its fulsome line of chocolates, even as it gained ownership of the Jenny Craig weight loss franchise, is evidence of the primacy of the profit incentive. So it's pointing out that Nestle bought the Jenny Craig weight loss food franchise, but still makes weight gain-causing sweets. It sells you the poison and the antidote. But relying on the solutions that emanate from the very paradigm that has created the problem means that we can never overcome them. Indeed, the weight loss industry has not solved our weight problem. Instead, it has made us hate ourselves, poisoned us with low-cal versions of the same chemicals that made us fat, meanwhile failing to offer us lasting weight loss. Audre Lorde's famous words ring true: the master's tools will not dismantle the master's house. If there is doubt that charity is a tool of the house of capitalism, of Wall Street, put it that way, then the circumstances of Crystal Pompidou's death should provide clarity. Pompidou was killed by an anti-theft feature of the clothing donation bin produced by Ragnarview Fabricating Inc. Pitch point bars intended to prevent removal of the bin's contents. The securitization of private property is a capitalist solution to a capitalist problem, right? Capitalism enforces ownership, that exclusive right to access and to withhold the fruits of our shared habitat, referring to nature, from others. Pompidou's death by a mechanism of private property enforcement was shocking, but it was part of a system that consistently takes life in much less spectacular ways. For example, Canada generates 13 million tons of food waste every year, even as 4 million Canadians experience food insecurity. Of course, just multiply the stats for America. In 2016, there were even more 1.3 million empty and mostly empty homes, even as over 200,000 people experience homelessness. Again, in the U.S., it's like 6 million empty homes, 1 million homeless people. Marie Kondo advises us that we have so much stuff that it makes us unhappy, even as a young woman is killed trying to access the very stuff just to survive. Upholding this cruelly absurd system implies no less than a lethal enforcement of private property. And that is seen in every death of a black person on the hands of police, or even when it's quote-unquote black-on-black crime, this is still people protecting their stuff with violence. Pompidou's death has not convinced us that we need to overhaul the system that creates obscene access for some and excruciating disposition for others. In response, Ragview Fabricating Inc. has halted production of that particular donation bin that killed her. The company is urging its charity partners to remove its anti-theft bars and is working with university students to design a new prototype. The Toronto mayor announced a review of the city's donation bin system. Kathy Crow, a Toronto street nurse and organizer with the newly formed group Shelter and Housing Justice, captures the inadequacy of the response. Quote, "We have a mayor that deals with homeless deaths by fixing the steel metal structure of the clothing donation box. And unsurprisingly, as long as the administrators of our system are also its beneficiaries, the solutions offered up will be of the damage control variety. Those intended not to destruct, but rather to restore what currently is." So how do we move beyond charity? Well, rather, now I made the case that we should. A charitable society is incompatible with a just one. The ability to give and the need to receive are equally products of a system that fails to distribute the world's resources so that everyone has what they need, not just to survive, but to thrive. Socialism is not equal redistribution of poverty, because that assumes poverty is natural. Poverty is created by inequality of how value is produced and then captured. It may be difficult for us to imagine a society in which decluttering disciples do not discard of their access through donation, where we do not depend on deadly pinch bars to enforce an unequal distribution of goods. But if we're unimaginative, it's not because alternatives do not exist, but because we are the products of capitalist philosophy and ourselves cognitively linked by its logical borders. So that's a bit of an academic jargon sentence. It means that our imagination is limited to what is and the kinds of relationships we're in now. And the true radical, revolutionary change agent approach is to expand those borders of our imagination and to imagine different ways of being. And I encounter these people, and they're the most well-adjusted, happy, interesting people doing interesting things. And I love community projects that do that stuff. It is within this logic that we seek relief inside the metal walls of a clothing donation box. For some of us, effective relief. For others, political relief. And for Crystal and too many others, physical relief. Yet, as surely as this box offers us its protection, it also confines us. For Crystal, it also proved suffocating. Her death is yet another reminder that we should not have needed. This box does not need reinforcement. It needs dismantling. And that was from Roar Magazine. Well, I have a piece here that is about the right to repair and about, you know, you don't have to throw out things and be wasteful if we can repair and reuse things ourselves. And a lot of companies have put in barriers to doing that. But I think what I'll finish with is from a piece that's kind of long-winded, but I'm only going to cite some of it, is called Sustainability is Not Enough, We Need Regenerative Cultures by Daniel Wall. And so I'm going to start with a little piece here where he describes the precautionary principle, what I was poking at a little earlier on in the hour, and how sustainability isn't enough because it's about kind of keeping things the same, using the same amount of resources or something like that. It's not an adequate goal. The word sustainability itself is inadequate, as it does not tell us what we are trying to sustain. Right? Sustain what? Our capitalist hell world that destroys the environment? Or rather, maybe it won't destroy the environment anymore, but it'll still be destroying ourselves as people. In 2005, after spending 2 years working on a doctoral thesis on design and sustainability, I began to realize that what we are trying to sustain is the underlying pattern of health and adaptability that maintain this planet and condition world life as a whole can flourish. That's his definition. So he talks about regenerative design and using the precautionary principle. One proposal for guiding wise action in the face of dynamic complexity, meaning how interconnected everything is, and not knowing, right? It's wisdom comes from knowing what you don't know, and not trying to intervene in where you don't know, and over-intervening, and trying to predict everything. If we just had more data, we could predict everything. That is wrong. Smart cities lead to dumb citizens. Okay, precautionary principle. So smart citizens, as a framework that aims to avoid, as far as possible, actions that will negatively impact our environment and health. And this is all the way back from the United Nations World Charter for Nature in 82, and all the other treaties that aren't really effective. But the widespread consensus statement on the precautionary principle states, when an activity raises threats of harm and to human health or the environment, a precautionary measure should be taken even if some cause and effect relationships are not fully established. The principle puts the burden of proof that a certain action is not harmful on those proposing and taking the action. So, for example, new company comes out with a product, okay, whatever it is, let's say a shampoo. They need to prove that the shampoo won't give you skin cancer before it should go to market. Now, as it is, they don't have to do that. They do product testing on animals. We can talk to a vegan to talk about how bad that is. But there's no long-term study. There's a lot still not known. Like they just test it to make sure that it doesn't like make your head explode or just cause you to break out into rashes. But they're limited, and especially since animal studies are not human studies. They don't actually do full human testing, at least not wide enough that it takes a lot more people into account. You don't know. You don't know how this shampoo will affect everyone. You don't know how it'll affect the environment. Maybe it'll turn the frogs gay. And we just don't know. There's a lot you don't know. But we should know before a product goes to market. Now, it does cost a lot, but that's putting the cost, the environmental, social, and physical costs, and healthcare costs, and front-loading those costs. So instead of, and it's putting it on the manufacturers, the capitalists, those making them, instead of the cost being either on the public dime, if it's an environmental cost, on ourselves as we pay for healthcare privately. And that would be state costs if it ever did shift to single payer, and so on. And social costs. Of course, shampoo doesn't really have social costs, but let's say it causes brain damage after a decade of use. So yes, yet general practice continues to allow all actions that have not yet been proven to have potentially harmful effects to go ahead unscrutinized. In a nutshell, the precautionary principle can be summarized as follows. Practice precaution in the face of uncertainty. This is not what we are doing. While high-level UN groups and many national governments have repeatedly considered this as a wise way to guide actions, day-to-day practice shows that it is very hard to implement, as it does counter-capitalist logic, as there will always be some degree of uncertainty. Precautionary principle could also potentially stop sustainable innovation and block potentially high benefit technologies on the basis that it cannot be proven with certainty that these technologies will not result in an unexpected future side effect that could be detrimental. So why not challenge designers, technologists, policymakers, and planners, professionals to evaluate their proposed actions on their positive, life-sustaining, restorative, and regenerative potential? Why not limit the scale of implementation of any innovation to local and regional levels until proof of its positive impact is unequivocally demonstrated? Aiming to design for systemic health may not save us from unexpected side effects and uncertainty, but it offers a trial and error path towards regenerative culture, actually using science We urgently need a Hippocratic oath for design, technology, and planning. Do no harm. To make this ethical imperative operational, possible, we need a salutogenic, meaning health-generating, intention behind all of this. We need to design for human ecosystems and planetary health. This way, we can move more swiftly from the unsustainable business as usual to restorative and regenerative innovations that will support and transition toward the regenerative culture. Let us ask ourselves, how do we create, design, technology, plan, and our policy decisions that positively support our collective health? We need to respond to the fact that human activity over the last centuries and millennia have done damage to ecosystems, their functioning. As resource availability is declining globally, demand is rising as the human population grows, and we continue to erode ecosystems. Now, this guy is an anti-capitalist, it seems, but I just want to put in the context that you can talk about this stuff and without being a leftist or anti-capitalist or saying we need socialism. But as far as eco-socialism is concerned, that's what he's describing. And because what he's describing, which is good and it's what we need, and it needs to be accepted or proven, or there just needs to be more public debate about it so more people can be thinking about how that this way of doing things, the better way, is incompatible with the current way. That's what paradigm shift means. That's what revolution means. That we do need a different system, phasing one into another. How do we do that is open. Some answers are that we need to take state power and impose this new paradigm. Bottom-up approach is that we change the paradigm one block at a time, then one city at a time. But it's what's frustrating is that many cities, like my municipality, my city, does take a kind of precautionary principle when it comes to community stuff, things that would actually benefit the community. When it comes to capitalist development, it's all good. No need to, it's communities then need to force them to study their impacts. When it comes to the impact of, say, having a bike sharing program, we need to test that first. We need to use the precautionary principle, which is fine. But when something like bike sharing has been done in many, many other cities and has been shown to be very, very good in most, if not all cases, then we should just do it. Like with road diets and whatever. We don't need to test it for 2 years. We don't have to wait. We were out of time. As I said, we've wasted enough time trying to recycle and trying to have green capitalism and trying to not solve the underlying issues of hierarchy and domination and oppression. It's all in our lives. It's everywhere. We're all complaining about it, even if we don't know it. You don't hate Mondays. You hate capitalism. So with that egregiously aggressive, a set of sentences, I will end the show. So this has been the Three Left Show. We are leaving the rat race for the rat sit-in. And I urge you all to be well and be your best selves, as I know you are. You are loved. I love you all. Full solidarity. Thank you very much. This has been Three Left Show, WCAA Community Radio.